Ta-Nehisi Coates could have made his new book a compilation of his essays as national correspondent for The Atlantic and just left it at that. But this is Ta-Nehisi Coates. In his best-selling book, Between the World and Me, he writes to his then 15-year-old son, "I tell you now that the question of how one should live within a black body is the question of my life." And indeed, over and over, he takes that question, chews on it, spits it out, then chomps on it again, first on his blog, then his magazine articles, then his books. His new book includes not just his essays, but a reevaluation of them. Did they hold up? What would he have done differently? The book is We Were 8 Years in Power, an echo of the words of South Carolina Congressman Thomas Miller in 1895, as the promise of post-Civil War reconstruction mutated into a re-oppression of blacks under Jim Crow. And Ta-Nehisi Coates joins us now from the NPR studios in New York. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Robin.
How would you characterize this? I mean, I kind of see it as you know, thinking about what you wrote along the way over the past 8 years. Is that an accurate depiction of it?
Yeah, that's pretty good. I think you had it exactly right. I mean, initially, I was signed up just to do, you know, kind of best of collection. I'd done a number of essays for The Atlantic, and the thought was these could be packaged together. Brief introduction and a brief intro, outro. And as I started looking back at the work, and I started looking back at some of the blogging I had done in that period, I thought there might be something more.
And of course, I mentioned the title, We Were 8 Years in Power. You are now talking about the 8 years of the Obama administration. How are you characterizing them, given that you're referencing 1895?
The first part of that, as you mentioned, it comes from Congressman Thomas Miller, and he is grappling with the question, why, after a period of Reconstruction, when a generation of black people coming out of slavery who were given the keys of governance in, you know, collaboration with white citizens who had worked with them in South Carolina, had done a pretty responsible and remarkable job, why it was that South Carolina answered that by stripping them of their rights? In much the same way, I think there's some question after these past 8 years of, you know, a relatively scandal-free government. Doesn't mean you have to agree with everything Obama did. I think Obama was right about everything, but you know, he certainly held himself up as presentable and, you know, as an honorable person in the tradition of American presidents. Why was the response to that, you know, as I write, you know, this kind of oafish man who, for the first time in American history, was invited into the White House having never served in the military, having never served in any political office? And I think it's one of the more vexing questions of African-American life.
Well, what's your answer?
My answer is the answer of W.E.B. Du Bois, who answered that in South Carolina. But I think this speaks to America at large. The only thing white South Carolina feared more than bad Negro government was good Negro government. That, in fact, the accomplishments were actually the problem, because the accomplishments, the presentation of black people as normal in their, you know, sort of bourgeois, everyday, easily integratable manner into America actually was an attack on whiteness and white supremacy in and of itself. It attacked the very precepts of that idea. And I think that explains a lot about what happened over the last 8 years and why the reaction was what it was.
Well, and of course, President Trump's many supporters would say, you know, many different things. And one of the things they'd say is that because they're tired of government in general, that they want to change, that their jobs were disappearing. I'm going to put that aside because you respond to that as well. But can I ask you a question?
Sure.
About this moment in time? Because one of the things we read about is, you know, your growth as a writer. You go from somebody who didn't have a paycheck to somebody who's much acclaimed. But with that came something that you seem to be uncomfortable with, which is being cast as the interpreter of all things black, as you got called up by white journalists like me to comment on current events. And I want to ask you to comment on current events. How do you feel about that?
I don't mind people calling me up to ask me about current events. I wish there was more space, though. There is an unfortunate tradition in this, you know, dialogue of quote-unquote race relations in this country where people are selected at various moments to be spokespeople, you know, for what right now is a, you know, a community of 40 million people. You know, obviously I write and I write for the public and I want my thoughts considered. I want my writings considered. But I didn't ask for a crown. And that's kind of what has happened, honestly, to be straight with you. Because with that comes assumptions about, you know, what you're saying and what you're supposed to do. You lose some of your freedoms as a writer. You lose your ability to be curious in public because, you know, you have a crown on now. You're supposed to have the answers. it is probably the most regrettable development.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, personally for me, out of the past 8 years.
Well, and you write that your success is directly tied to Barack Obama's presidency. You know, he's directly responsible for a crop of black writers and commentators. And you're absolutely right, because we remember in the run-up in the campaign, yes, of course we had sources, but suddenly everybody was scrambling to get more.
And that was good and bad, you know? Like, it was good from the perspective, as you said, I didn't have a career before Barack Obama. And I don't think I would have had one, at least like I have now, if not for, you know, I have to be honest about that. In some ways, it opened up a market, you know? And there are, and I, you know, I don't want to, in my own protestings, erase the fact that there are a number of incredible, incredible black journalists who sprung up in the wake of Obama. My friend Jelani Cobb at the New York, and Nicole Hannah-Jones at the New York Times Magazine, a number of people were just, you know, writing beautifully, because I largely think as an indirect result of Obama, people were much more curious about black life.
Well, what I wanted to ask you about, I thought of when I was reading your essay, Fear of a Black President. This is the essay you wrote about Barack Obama. You talk about how this black president, you know, might have unleashed the white supremacist forces that you talked about because of the title of the piece, Fear of a Black President. But as I was reading it, one stanza from poet Lucille Clifton seemed to feel so much a part of today. You were talking about how people become, you know, radicalized. It. You write, my own father went to Vietnam dreaming of John Wayne, but came back quoting Malcolm X. Can you read a little of that stanza?
They act like they don't love their country. No, what it is they found out their country don't love them.
Of course, I'm thinking of NFL football players taking a knee.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And not just them taking a knee, but the response to them taking a knee. You know, there was a game in which the Dallas Cowboys were able to draw a kind of compromise between themselves and their owner, who's totally against Colin Kaepernick's protest and kneeling before the flag, where they kneeled before the national anthem, not while the national anthem was playing, but before the national anthem. They got booed anyway, which, you know, clearly demonstrates that there is something going on beyond, you know, some degree of disrespect for the flag and the national anthem.
Look, Ta-Nehisi Coates, that 2012 essay about Barack Obama was one you felt worked, but you start your new book right off with your 2008 Bill Cosby essay, and you don't hold back. Mm-hmm. You say in every piece, the essays, there's a story I told and a story I didn't, for better or worse. In the case of Bill Cosby, it was for worse. This was my shame. This was my failure. And it's how this story starts. And then we launch into reading your Bill Cosby essay, in which you don't really talk about the accusations against him.
Yeah, it was a huge failure. You know, all these pieces come from deeply personal places, and they aren't really separable from my life. And at that point, as I, you know, articulated at the beginning of the book, I was an incredibly struggling writer. I had no, like, real notion of what was coming or what I was going to become. Later on, I became much more courageous about times when I needed to have confrontations with my editors. Mm. But I was aware of those allegations. And I think, you know, in my mind, I was writing one piece, and to have to try to write this other piece would have really, really complicated it. And I didn't know whether I was capable of it. This is my first shot at The Atlantic. It's my first piece, you know, of this length at a magazine like this. So why not narrow the story? In fact, what I know now is it would have dovetailed perfectly with it, and it would have complicated it in a really, really beautiful way. Mm. But that was a failure.
Overall, what would you say about your body of work? Because as you well know, especially after your book to your son came out, there were other black writers in particular who said, wait, this is way too cynical. What was it? Thomas Chatterton Williams, a woefully skewed way of looking at the world. Unlike Baldwin, he wrote a lettered book to his nephew. You were writing to your son. He had so much more hope than you seem to have, it would seem.
I don't think so.
No?
You know what I think? I think for a very, very long time, the vast majority of this country has been spoon-fed its history as though they were two-year-old children. This is about intellectual maturity. I know there is a desire to be read a bedtime story and to be patted on the head and told, in the end, the good guys win. But no one actually knows whether that's true. And that hasn't been true for, you know, generations of African Americans. We had 250 years of enslavement in this country versus we're just, you know, getting over 150 years or so of freedom. What that means is for the majority of the time that black people have been in this country, they've been enslaved. the expectation that you will take all of that into consideration, to say nothing about Jim Crow, to say nothing about the era of lynching, to say nothing about this era that we live in right now, where the people who I pay my taxes to protect me don't have the same relationship to me as they do in other communities, that one should somehow in some sort of literary way at the end of the day say, but everything's going to be okay. Is it? How do you know that? How do you know everything's going to be okay? My job is to tell the truth as I see it. You know, I'm not anybody's pastor. I'm not anybody's prophet. That's not my job, you know? But I think for a lot of Black writing, because this thing is so close to the bone of who we are as an Americans, this is the idea that you should get a bedtime story. And I'm just not going to do that. I'll never do that. It'd be a massive betrayal, you know, of the form.
That's Ta-Nehisi Coates. His new collection of his essays written for The Atlantic, including his thoughts about them now, We Were 8 Years in Power, An American Tragedy. Ta-Nehisi, thanks so much.
Thank you.